each of which equaled their German counterparts for equipment and firepower, and a British armoured brigade. Even so, Corporal Josef B. of the 2nd Panzer Division was confident his formation would overcome the British. "They don't shoot badly. You notice you have an opponent before you, probably Tommies, but they really just want to re-embark again. We took a few prisoners, proud lads, but we'll soon cut them down to size." The British were not helped by the pressure they were now under from the Axis in North Africa, which compelled them to commit only 80 aircraft to the Greek theatre. The Greek army, like the Yugoslav army, lacked anti-aircraft and anti-tank guns, and had also been weakened by its battles against the Italians. But Greece's poor road system, its challenging terrain, and the Germans' need for reinforcements all frustrated their overland pursuit of the British. Moreover, poor weather disrupted German air attacks. The Luftwaffe harried the British by day, but its attacks were blunted by fuel shortages, effective British camouflage, and a skillfully dispersed British marching order that enabled at least some British units to move at night. Fierce resistance, particularly from the Australians and New Zealanders at Olympus and Thermopylae, delayed the Germans' pursuit on the ground. When the Greeks surrendered on 23 April, the British were able to withdraw much of their 60,000-plus force, transferring some personnel to defend the island of Crete. While the latter remained in Allied hands, it could threaten Axis control of the eastern Mediterranean and Axis supply through the Corinth Canal. German army troops did not lead the assault on the island. That distinction went to the men of the Luftwaffe's 7th Fallschirmjäger, parachute division, though the startling losses the paratroopers suffered deterred Hitler from using airborne troops against other major targets in the future. Crete's fall concluded the Balkan campaign. Emphatic as the German victory had been, the delay the campaign had caused did not help preparations for Operation Barbarossa. The Balkan campaign was also significant for another reason. The Heydrich-Wagner Agreement of 26 March 1941 had authorized the SS to take all action necessary against emigrants, saboteurs, and terrorists in the Soviet territories occupied by the army. An equivalent directive for the Balkan campaign, issued by General Halder on 2 April, actually widened the target groups to include Jews and communists. This was not just a harbinger of what would follow in the Soviet Union. It also demonstrates how uninhibited the army leadership was becoming about the kind of campaign Barbarossa would be. The Balkan campaign also offered a glimpse of how soldiers might conduct themselves when faced with civilian resistance in the Soviet Union. On 21 April, a German officer was killed in the Serb village of Donji Dobrich. Colonel General von Weichs, commander of the Second Army, proclaimed that seeing as Serb men should be assumed guilty unless proven otherwise, all men in the vicinity capable of bearing arms should be seized and shot unless they could immediately and indisputably demonstrate their innocence. He also directed that, as an example to others, all those shot are to be hanged, their corpses are to be left hanging. Invading the Soviet Union in 1941 seemed to offer a chance, however precarious, of breaking the Reich's strategic impasse with a spectacular land-based campaign of the kind at which the German army could excel. The army did not enjoy overwhelming superiority over its opponent, and its logistical grasp fell short of what the campaign demanded. But the practical misgivings numerous senior commanders held were outweighed by the professional arrogance felt by the bulk of the senior officer corps, their hubris swelling following the campaigns in the West and in the Southeast, the welter of upbeat intelligence on the state of the Red Army, and commanders' broad agreement with the invasion's strategic, economic, and ideological goals. Further, the army leadership did not just agree when Hitler insisted that the practical challenges of campaigning in the Soviet Union and the bestial nature of the enemy the Germans faced necessitated exceptionally harsh conduct. It implemented Hitler's wishes diligently, particularly in the criminal orders it issued to the troops, and the great majority of senior field commanders endorsed its efforts. The motivation shared by the army leadership and by senior field commanders combined the ideological with the pragmatic, and was all the harsher for it. It included contempt for Eastern peoples, deep aversion to Bolshevism, and the imperative of plundering the Soviet Union of its foodstuffs. It also included the need for SS manpower in pacifying the rear, in a campaign that the army's own ruthless approach to irregular resistance would also help to drive. The potential for brutality in the corpus of measures that resulted was something a number of commanders would try to water down, but hardly any would try to challenge fundamentally. Thus was the German army committed to a campaign that would transform the scale, nature, and direction of the war it was fighting. Chapter 8. Barbarossa Unleashed, 1941. German soldiers, you are now entering into a hard struggle, heavy with responsibility. For the fate of Europe, the future of the German Reich, the existence of our nation, are now in your hands alone. Thus did Hitler address the troops when the Germans unleashed Operation Barbarossa on 22 June 1941. The German invasion of the Soviet Union propelled the Second World War into a six-month period that would eventually prove to be its most important turning point. The first stage, from late June to mid-August 1941, saw the Wehrmacht achieve astonishing operational triumphs against the Red Army. But for the first time, it had taken on too much to enable it to achieve the early decisive strategic triumph that was needed. Moreover, indoctrination, criminal orders, and extreme conditions in the field all combined to brutalize the conduct of the German army's campaign. The opening hours of the German attack seemed to banish any apprehension the Germans might have felt hitherto. "The air roars," recounts the post-war history of the 17th Panzer Division's 40th Rifle Regiment. "Commands can barely be understood. Our infantry guns fire 60 rounds per gun in 10 minutes. Flak guns finish off the bunkers along the enemy bank. Soon, fires on the other side of the River Bug can be seen. At 0340 hours, the bombs from the Stukas strike the enemy positions. From 0415 hours, the transport of troops and weapons across the river begins." When the Germans attacked, their aerial and artillery bombardment devastated the Soviet frontier army's uneven communication system. The mayhem that resulted was immediate. For instance, the war diary of the 129th Infantry Division, fighting with Panzer Group 3 in Army Group Center, recorded, "The prisoners give the impression of having been totally surprised by the attack. Some say they had neither weapons nor munitions to hand. Others admit they were surprised while asleep. They appear to some extent without boots or socks." The Luftwaffe devastated Soviet air forces in the forward areas. For instance, the Baltic Military District lost more than 900 of its 1,080 aircraft in the campaign's first 3 days. Inexperienced Soviet pilots who did get into the air could not catch the Luftwaffe's bombers. Second Lieutenant Helmut D. of the 258th Infantry Division, a fourth wave formation serving under Army Group Center around Brest and Białystok during the campaign's opening days, wrote, "Our march columns continue forward without interruption. They often make wonderful targets for Russian planes, but the Russian Air Force is so weakened that it is nowhere to be seen." Panzer Group 3 reported, "The teamwork with 8th Air Corps was particularly close and lively. Control of the air was almost totally achieved on the first day of the attack. Higher-level Russian leadership did not make an appearance at all during the first days. Lower leadership was inert, mechanical, and lacked resolve in adapting to the situation as it developed. Orders were found which, despite knowing about German progress in the morning, demanded that a defensive line be occupied in the evening, which we had already reached in the afternoon. Their methodical training was no match for the huge impact of the surprise." The bedlam that engulfed much of the Soviet front line that day was largely the fault of Stalin and the Red Army leadership. It is commonly believed that the German attack caught Stalin completely by surprise. Stalin was not nearly that stupid, but he and the Red Army leadership did make several eventually calamitous misjudgments during the months before the invasion. Stalin believed Hitler would turn on the Soviet Union eventually, but did not think him mad enough to try it as early as 1941, with Britain still in the war. Stalin scorned British efforts to warn him otherwise and accepted official assurances by Field Marshal von Brauchitsch in July 1940 that rumours of German-Soviet tensions were first and foremost outpourings of English propaganda. He was equally scathing about reports from his own intelligence services. Although Stalin accepted that a German attack was likely at some stage, he and the Red Army leadership badly misjudged the requirements of effective defence. The Red Army's mobilization plan of October 1940 envisaged distributing 171 divisions in three successive defensive belts or operational echelons. Stalin could have made much more of the advantage of space that the Soviet Union possessed. However, instead of amassing still more reserves and contemplating strategic withdrawals, he wanted the Red Army to defend the entire Soviet frontier. In the fear-filled atmosphere of Stalin's Soviet Union, it would have been a brave soul indeed who highlighted the folly of these arrangements. The quality of the forward formations was weak. Two-thirds of rank-and-file Soviet troops in the border military districts were in their first year of service, half of them having been drafted only that spring. The disastrous results of the Red Army's January 1941 war games made Stalin desperate to stave off war with Germany for as long as possible. By April 1941, relations between the Soviet Union and Germany were visibly deteriorating, and Soviet intelligence was detecting a build-up in German offensive preparations that Stalin could not ignore. The latter hoped that dissuading Hitler with active diplomacy would at least buy another year in which to complete the Soviet Union's defensive preparations. At the same time, he sought a partial mobilization of the Soviet forces, not enough to antagonize Hitler further, but enough, it was hoped, to ensure the Soviet Union would be sufficiently well defended should war come. With Stalin facing two ways simultaneously, Soviet military planning grew increasingly confused. On 22 June, the consequences were made clear. Stalin misjudged not only the timing of any German attack, but also its direction. The main question facing Soviet defensive planners was whether the main German attack would come north or south of the Pripyat Marshes. Stalin and the Red Army leadership concentrated their greatest defensive force on the Ukraine. Stalin was fixed on the Ukraine because he feared for its economic resources should the Germans attack, while the Red Army leadership was fixed on it because it believed that attack was the best form of defence, and that the Ukraine provided the best jumping-off point from which to drive into Axis territory in the event of war. In the immediate run-up to Barbarossa, Stalin willfully ignored several signs that an attack was imminent. The Germans craftily fed his delusions, with the OKW announcing that the German build-up in the east was a deception aimed at British intelligence. The Axis invasion of Yugoslavia and Greece also provided a good cover story. On 16 June, the German embassy in Moscow evacuated all non-essential personnel. While this at least might have rung Stalin's alarm bell, the OKW and the German Foreign Ministry provided a cover story here also, by claiming that the Germans were about to demand changes in Soviet policy or economic aid. Many Soviet commanders thus surmised that the Germans would precede any attack with an ultimatum. On 21 June, Stalin finally ordered his commanders to prepare for attack, but the poor Soviet communication system delayed or garbled the message. By the time the Germans attacked the following day, only a handful of Soviet commands were ready to act on Stalin's order. The Germans overwhelmed the Red Army's forward fronts before its still poorly trained, prepared, and equipped mechanized forces could counterattack effectively. Within 3 weeks, they had shattered its first two main lines of defense. Of the three German army groups, it was Bock's Army Group Center that made the most spectacular progress. Facing it was General D.G. Pavlov's Western Army Group. Army Group Center had two infantry armies, two panzer groups, and a major geographical advantage. The Soviet fronts to the north and south were protected on their flanks by the sea, but Pavlov's was not. Within a week, Army Group Center had encircled 30 Red Army divisions. The infantry encircled a Red Army force in and around Bialystok, an important transport hub, while the panzer groups raced eastwards to complete another, bigger encirclement in and around the Belarusian capital of Minsk. Guderian, wrote Helmut D., whose panzer group has broken through somewhat further south, has apparently said the devil can fricassee him if he isn't in Moscow in 8 days' time. Holt's panzer group did equally well. I really don't think this is going to last much longer, mused Corporal Franz F. with the 12th Panzer Division on 3 July, because we are thrusting ahead something wild. Resistance in the Minsk pocket ended on 8 July with the capture of 324,000 prisoners, the first in a series of enormous bags the Germans would achieve over the following 4 months. Guderian, ever intent on pressing forward, had wanted to push on as far as Smolensk so as to achieve an even bigger double encirclement, but Hitler had insisted on closing the ring and destroying the Minsk pocket conclusively first. The flanking army groups found the going harder. Field Marshal von Leib's Army Group North comprised two infantry armies and General Hoeppner's Panzer Group 4. It benefited from a jumping-off point in eastern Prussia that had good military bases and an efficient transport system. Most of the population of the Baltic states was relieved to be free of Soviet occupation. A day into the invasion, Private Waldo P. of the 1st Wave 5th Infantry Division described the soldiers' reception. We were greeted enthusiastically in the Lithuanian villages we passed through. Bunches of flowers and greenery were handed out to us, also milk and water. Army Group North's narrow front also enabled its forces to avoid becoming overstretched, at least initially. Yet Army Group North's progress was less spectacular than Army Group Center's. Its Red Army opponents benefited from the narrow front as much as Army Group North did, and the swampy, forested terrain was ideal for defense against armor. And even though Army Group North's infantry force could negotiate such terrain more easily, it was not large enough to encircle Red Army forces in any great size. Army Group North did take 75,000 prisoners, but most of the Red Army troops facing it were able to withdraw. The Soviets then set up a defensive line along the River Luga. Now, with Army Group North having to fan out as it advanced further eastwards, Leib had to make decisions about which objective to concentrate on the most. He wanted to clear the Baltics completely, but Hoeppner wanted to drive straight for Leningrad. Leib eventually fudged the issue by committing his panzers to both objectives simultaneously. In the event, Leningrad would not fall, and the Germans would feel compelled to subject it to a harrowing epic siege. Army Group North's failure to achieve decisive success was an early ominous sign that Operation Barbarossa was not running according to plan. Army Group South's advance initially appeared as unstoppable as Army Group Center's. "No bunker, no fortification can withstand our attack," wrote Lance Corporal G. of the 11th Panzer Division under General von Kleist's Panzer Group 1 in his diary entry of 23 June. Second Lieutenant Gerd A. of the 25th Infantry Division described shot-up tanks all over the place on the roads. "One day we counted more than 100. Destruction everywhere. There are whole villages and towns that you can erase from the map. Just smoking ruins." Field Marshal von Rundstedt's army group also comprised three infantry armies. Here, as in the Baltics, the population often greeted the Germans as liberators, a legacy of the catastrophic effect of Stalin's collectivization policies had had upon rural life in the Ukraine. "The population was to some extent quite affecting," wrote Second Lieutenant Helmut D. of the 4th Mountain Division, "and greeted us as liberators from the Bolshevik yoke. We were showered with garlands and Heil Hitlers." But Army Group South was advancing on a front more than twice as wide as Army Group Center's, and with fewer panzers. Its advance encountered unusually heavy rain in July, and, more importantly, the downside of the weakly held front facing Army Group Center. For General M.P. Kirponos's southwestern army group was considerably stronger than Pavlov's western army group. It also benefited from a southern flank guarded by the Black Sea. 2 days into the campaign, Rundstedt already recognized the difficulty. "It's not going to go as quickly as we hoped, or as we were used to before." Army Group South did encircle and capture 103,000 Soviet troops around Umania in early August, but the total number captured in the twin pockets at Minsk and Białystok dwarfed this figure. It was also a hard-fought battle that lasted 3 weeks. "Today was the hardest and worst so far," recounted Lance Corporal G's diary entry of 22 July. "With our attack on Uman, Major Fultz, Lieutenant Herold, and Zontag, our radio operator, were all killed by a direct hit from an anti-tank gun. Lieutenant Richter, Corporal Mützer, and Lance Corporal Tenzer were badly wounded. Dieserot, the commander's driver, was the only survivor. A sorry picture." Army Group South's tribulations similarly signified that Operation Barbarossa had taken on more than it could cope with. For now, General Hulder was far less concerned with sluggish progress on the flanks than with the central drive on Moscow. Yet even Army Group Center could not claim unqualified success. For a start, sealing the Minsk and Białystok pockets had exacted a heavy toll upon its two panzer groups. Even then, they had been unable to prevent considerable numbers of Red Army troops from slipping through to the east. The panzer groups had faced several Soviet armored counterattacks while they sealed the pocket, for though the Red Army executed its armored counterattacks ineptly during 1941, it was at least able to execute a lot of them. The panzers were not used to defensive warfare, and German infantry lacked effective anti-tank protection against Soviet armor. Sheer persistence, then, enabled Soviet armored attacks to whittle down the Germans' armored strength. General of Panzer Troops Joachim Lemelsen, commander of 46th Panzer Corps, described such an attack on 10 July. "The 17th Panzer Division, which is about 50 kilometers, 30 miles, away from us, was very heavily attacked the day before yesterday at Seno by at least one Russian armored division. The Russians were attacking from the north and south in massive waves with countless tanks." Lieutenant Erich Bunker of the 31st Infantry Division commanded an anti-tank infantry platoon that, in late July, encountered the T-34 for the first time. A monster like we had never seen before. It fired machine guns from the turret and from the bow side and shot at us with a big long-barreled gun. We shot back with 8 pack guns and watched as our shells struck against the armor plating and bounced off. One shot after another bounced off and whirled through the air, a ghastly sight. The T-34 was more heavily armed and armored than any panzer. Among other things, its cutting-edge, curvaceous armor enabled it to absorb hits more easily. The Mark IV was the only panzer model that came close to rivaling it for armor and armament, and the T-34 still outdid the Mark IV for speed. Fortunately for the Germans, they were now at least able to analyze the T-34 close up. Meanwhile, the Red Army still possessed too few for them to have a decisive effect, and had yet to learn how to concentrate them effectively. T-34s often lacked sufficient fuel and ammunition, and their crews were poorly trained. On the other hand, the fact that they existed and could already do considerable damage was yet another respect in which Operation Barbarossa was already proving more grueling than the Germans had expected. The execrable state of the roads wore the panzers down further. For instance, only a week into the invasion, the 7th Panzer Division had lost half its Mark IIs and IIIs and three-quarters of its Mark IVs. Indeed, the very speed of Army Group Center's advance created problems. Wachtmeister Josef L. of the 129th Infantry Division gained an inkling as early as 24 June of the problems that awaited foot-slogging infantry trying to keep up with the panzers. "The Russian has dissolved in fear before our motorized forces. The front is 80 kilometers, 50 miles ahead of us. It is simply impossible for us to keep in contact with the enemy. We are just too slow." In early July, Private Dr. Georg D. of the same division wrote a report on how the roads were affecting vehicles, horses, and soldiers. "The tired horses are often not in the condition to pull wagons that are sunk into the sand almost up to their ankles and laden with munitions and all manner of equipment. Here the human must help. Ropes are tied to the drawbar of every wagon. 10 to 20 infantrymen strain themselves, and thus go things further on until the most dangerous spots have been overcome. The trucks, assuming they cannot go overland, have tasks before them which no one could have imagined when they were built. The wheels grind into the deep sand, and drivers and passengers have to dig them out, putting boardwalks underneath, pushing, helped by neighboring trucks to pull comrades out of the muck." The gap already opening between the thrusting panzer divisions and the slogging infantry divisions could only increase. With this diminished the Germans' chances of encircling and destroying the Red Army's forces and of keeping Operation Barbarossa on track. After the initial shock of the German onslaught, the Red Army made the Germans pay for ground increasingly dearly, not just at Umania, but all along the front. The 4th Mountain Division's war diary for 26 June recorded, "Already in the first few days since the beginning of hostilities, the view is circulating that the Russian, as an individual fighter, displays extraordinary harshness and tenacity, coupled with bestial cruelty and underhandedness. The Red Army's troops inflicted still heavier casualties on the Germans when, as the 25th Infantry Division reported, their foxholes were so deep that artillery fire could not destroy them, and German infantry had to finish the job in close combat. The Soviets' own infantry counterattacks were crude at first, consisting of little more than vast charging waves of soldiers whom the Germans mowed down in droves. Soon, however, they were executing attacks more adeptly, often using forests and cornfields as cover. On 1 July, the 119th Motorized Infantry Regiment, with the 25th Infantry Division, described the enemy's efforts as courageous, more ruthless than the French, and skillfully exploiting the terrain. General Reinhardt, who had helped train the Red Army during its covert cooperation with the Reichswehr, dryly confessed in a letter to his wife, "Sometimes I almost fear that I taught the brothers too well." By mid-August, the 4th Mountain Division had already suffered casualties of 303 dead, 909 wounded, and 85 missing. On 3 August, Lance Corporal Josef M. of the 5th Infantry Division, now under the 9th Army in Army Group Center, reported, "There are companies in our regiment that have lost half their combat strength in battle. German infantry fared especially badly against Soviet tanks. And as early as 1 July, the 326th Infantry Regiment, fighting under the 198th Infantry Division in the 11th Army, suffered 80 dead, 104 wounded, and 147 missing when it came under attack from Soviet tanks. Many of its troops fled. This suggests that reserve divisions such as the 198th sometimes lacked the mettle of the Army's active divisions." The effects on the German troops were mental as well as physical. "My feet are in order, and my nerves are probably getting used to a lot," wrote Unteroffizier Willy F. of the 198th Infantry Division on 16 July. "We've had a lot of losses through nervous shock and so on, even though in my own view the situation was bearable. It's a gift of God that I'm still alive," wrote 2nd Lieutenant Helmut D. of the 4th Mountain Division 3 weeks later. "The Russian was constantly trying to break out and was driven back every time. 8 days and nights in a hole in the ground without sleep, come rain or shine. My nerves nearly broke, the cries of the charging Russians ringing constantly in my ears." Lieutenant Schmidt of the 121st Infantry Division, advancing with Army Group North, described the Red Army's Asiatic soldiers as inhuman and highly dangerous. "Of course, the soldiers out of the Caucasus are nasty in their grinning fanaticism. One fights against them as one would against animals." Schmidt did not let anti-Slavic racism cloud his judgment entirely. On another occasion, he wrote that "these propaganda company reports make one sick, even when they are well written, because they try to paint the serious, manly events theatrically. We speak of Russians while the propaganda people only speak of the Reds." Schmidt then apparently saw the campaign more as a contest of arms than an anti-Bolshevik or anti-Slavic crusade. More often, however, German troops attributed their opponents' ferocity and cruelty to the supposedly heinous influence of the Red Army's Jew-Bolshevik commissars. "They attack like madmen," wrote 2nd Lieutenant Helmut H. of the 258th Infantry Division. "When a comrade falls, they carry on undaunted. They rarely surrender. The Red Army's officers and commissars have worked up their men into a fear psychosis." The 129th Infantry Division's intelligence section described the commissars of the opposing Soviet 922nd Rifle Regiment as Jewish to an extent, constantly driving the men to new attacks while they and some of the officers stay behind and shoot anyone refusing to attack. 39 Corps issued a memorandum stating that under the Commissar's influence, the Red Army's soldiers became wild animals in battle. Not only senior army commands, but also the army's field newspapers fueled the Commissar's demonic image. In June 1941, for instance, the field newspaper Blücher claimed that the Red soldier is persuaded by his political commissars that he will be shot in German captivity. It will be clear from these quotations, as indeed from the evidence generally, that units willingly perpetrated the Commissar order not only due to anti-Bolshevism, but also due to their harsh perception of military necessity. The time pressures of Barbarossa brooked no delay. Thus, vilified as the inciters of dogged Red Army resistance, the Commissars were marked men. Over 3,400, mostly political officers of the Red Army, were executed by the Germans during 1941 and 1942. 3,400 was a small proportion of the total number of Red Army soldiers whom the Germans captured, but a very high proportion of the officers captured. It might have been higher still, but for the fact that as word of the Commissar order got round the Red Army's units, Commissars were likely to burn their papers and means of identification before they were captured. From October onwards, German Army intelligence officers in the SS and police screened Red Army commissars who had been sent to prison camps, and as a result of this thorough procedure, many more were exposed and executed. According to an exhaustive recent study, reports of shootings exist for all 13 armies, all 44 Army Corps, and more than 80% of divisions, a figure that rises to 90% if we include additional cases where there are indications of shootings. Nor do these figures provide the comfort of knowing that between 10 and 20% of the Army's divisions were chivalrous enough to spurn the order. Some may have been, but the written record only provides clear evidence for General Stapf's 111th Infantry Division. A mundane but plausible alternative explanation would be that more divisions carried out the order but left no written record. What the figures certainly show is that anti-Bolshevism and a sense of ruthless military necessity had penetrated the Army's officer corps extensively. For senior commanders were not compelled to carry out the order under duress. No written record exists of any officer whose refusal to carry it out brought him so much as a reprimand. Nevertheless, some divisions did not carry out the Commissar order as much as others. Here, a divisional commander's moral or political values might have a part to play. Major General Wilhelm Ritter von Thoma was no friend of the Nazis. His hands were not clean. A report of 27 September 1941 recorded that his 17th Panzer Division had shot 9 commissars in as many days, but the staunchly National Socialist Major General Ludwig Kruvel's 11th Panzer Division reported shooting 10 commissars on 14 July alone. This suggests that while divisional commanders might not personally have ordered individual executions, they set the tone among their subordinates. More important than a divisional commander's demeanour was how much opportunity his troops had to kill commissars. Panzer units shot more commissars than frontline infantry units did. Each infantry corps shot an average of 31 while the Commissar order was active, but Panzer Corps, which took larger numbers of prisoners, shot an average of more than 73. Then again, attitudes towards the enemy among Panzer troops may well have been harsher than those of the infantry. Leaving aside anti-Bolshevism, the Panzer divisions and the Nazi movement alike were fixated on technological modernity, and Panzer personnel, as the German Army's earlier campaigns had shown, felt immense pride in being the modern technological vanguard of the German Army's triumphs. More straightforwardly, they were high on success during the Eastern Campaign's opening weeks, just as they had been on a high during the Army's earlier victorious campaigns. With a mind frame such as this, one did not even need to be a fervent National Socialist to feel the kind of ruthless triumphalism that made it easier to perpetrate criminal acts. But it was rear area units, particularly security divisions, that had the greatest opportunity to shoot commissars. For such units were under none of the time pressure that advancing frontline units faced, and could therefore take the trouble to root out commissars properly. Harder to establish is how the individual soldiers who perpetrated the killings actually felt about their role as hangman's assistants. The written record provides few indications, though divisional chaplains were often set to work trying to ameliorate the guilt soldiers may have felt. Red Army commissars did go to ferocious lengths to terrorize their men into fighting. Among other things, they set up blocking detachments almost immediately after the invasion's start, which were issued orders to fire upon retreating Red Army soldiers. But the Germans themselves gave commissars ample grounds for ferocity, because commissars knew they could expect a bullet if the Germans captured and identified them. An early example of the penny dropping for the Germans came during the second week of September, when Army Group North's chief of staff argued that the commissars should be handled civilly so as to speed up their desertion. Such joined-up thinking was rare during Barbarossa's opening months. Nor did many German commands apparently have the wit to recognize that the Red Army's soldiers might be fighting for other reasons as well as the influence of their commissars. That said, 26th Corps did argue that the feeling may exist in these people that they must defend their land against attacking foreigners, and the 9th Army's command gained the strong impression of a young, unspoiled people that is also loyal to its fatherland and is prepared to stand up, if not for the communist state, then for Russia. Such saner reflections only became commonplace when Barbarossa's heady initial phase was over and the Germans contemplated the prospect of a much longer struggle. By giving commissars sound reason to whip up their own troops into an anti-German frenzy, and indeed by attacking the Soviet Union without warning in the first place, the Wehrmacht as a whole played the greater role in initiating a spiral of reciprocal terror and savagery. But reciprocal, the terror and savagery certainly were. Moreover, Nazi propaganda vastly exploited evidence of the atrocities that units of the Soviet secret police, the NKVD, had committed before retreating. The grimmest example was the discovery of 5,300 corpses in Lemberg at the end of June 1941, left there after retreating NKVD units had murdered their political prisoners. The 4th Mountain Division, involved in the fighting to clear the city, similarly discovered the bodies of numerous Ukrainians at Brezhany on 4 July. On the outskirts of the town, its men found meadows containing the bodies of more civilians whom the NKVD had shot. Soviet atrocities, real, exaggerated, or invented, and it seems there were a lot of all three kinds, were grist to the Nazi propaganda mill. By hearing of atrocities through propaganda or seeing the evidence up close, German units that might not have been especially brutally disposed at the campaign's start might become so as the campaign went on. The same applied to Soviet propaganda's effect upon Red Army units. Precise causes and effects might differ for each unit, but the general effects were felt on the battlefield, as units from both sides committed atrocities, particularly against prisoners. "The Russians are not giving up," wrote 2nd Lieutenant Helmut D. on 1 July. "Their wounded fire on us too, and so do the prisoners. The Russians themselves hardly ever take prisoners. I've seen graves in which German soldiers lay after being shot as prisoners." In a letter to his wife on 6 July, General of Infantry Gotthard Heinritzi, commander of the 4th Army's 43 Corps, recounted an incredibly bloody action when, in some cases, we gave no quarter at all. The Russian was like a beast towards our injured soldiers. In return, our men shot and beat to death everything in brown uniforms. Reports of German prisoners of the Red Army being killed and mutilated, and not necessarily in that order, were commonplace, and at least some Red Army units needed less provocation than others. For instance, on the very first day of the campaign, Dr. Heinrich Harper, a medical doctor with the 6th Infantry Division, discovered the bodies of a German doctor, a stretcher-bearer, and 4 wounded soldiers whom the Soviets had killed even when the doctor had waved his Red Cross flag. German units likewise contributed further to the deadly self-reinforcing cycle and to Red Army resilience by killing surrendering Red Army soldiers themselves. In the heat of a battle, the moment of surrender was, and is, always dangerous. Surrendering soldiers were even more likely to be shot out of hand if they were resisting fiercely just minutes before, as so many Red Army soldiers did. But in the war in the East, troops on both sides were even more likely to shoot out of hand because they had been saturated with incendiary propaganda. Indeed, German soldiers were shooting surrendering Red Army soldiers during the campaign's opening weeks on a scale that alarmed even the OKH, albeit for practical rather than moral reasons. Thus, on 9 July, did Field Marshal von Brauchitsch try to discourage German troops from wildly killing surrendering Red Army soldiers, fearing, as he did, that increasingly embittered fighting could result. Only rarely did German army units systematically kill all surrendering Red Army soldiers during or immediately after battle, though some units, almost pathologically revolted by the idea of women in combat, did issue orders to shoot women in uniform. By contrast, the gentlemanly General Stapf of the 111th Infantry Division decreed that not all Soviet women are rifle sluts, Flintenweiber, and particularly advised his men that Soviet nurses enjoyed protection under international law. Another unit that treated its prisoners decently was the 4th Panzer Division, which strove to provide captured enemy wounded with the necessary medical treatment immediately after battle. One did not need to be especially virtuous to see the value in such conduct, just sensible enough to recognize that it could also save German lives by making Red Army soldiers regard the prospect of surrender as more appealing. Although Red Army soldiers were resisting bitterly, they were also surrendering in huge numbers. Rather simplistically, German army intelligence officers who later interviewed Soviet POWs attributed these mass surrenders to Red Army soldiers' immature mentality. They resisted ferociously if their officers and commissars ordered them to, but reverted to an almost childlike state and surrendered en masse once their leaders had been put out of action. For instance, when on 15 July the 4th Mountain Division attacked Red Army bunkers on the Stalin line in the Ukraine, it captured a number of Ukrainian troops who greeted the prospect of German captivity with relief. Had captured Red Army soldiers been able to foresee the fate that would eventually befall them in the German POW camps, most probably would have fought to the death. As it was, the scale of mass surrender was not so great as to diminish decisively the Red Army's generally phenomenal will to resist. Meanwhile, Stalin himself sought further to escalate the intensity of the fighting, this time in those regions the Germans had conquered. On 3 July, he addressed the Soviet people and commanded them to rise up in the Germans' rear to liberate not just the Soviet Union but also Nazi-controlled Europe. Anywhere and everywhere, diversion groups must fight the enemy's units and support the partisan effort by blowing up bridges and roads, destroying telephone and telegraph communications, and burning forests, depots, and trains. For the enemy, as indeed for all his accomplices and collaborators, conditions in the occupied areas must be made unbearable. He must be hunted down and exterminated, and all his plans foiled. Though Stalin's entreaties did not entirely fall on deaf ears, such Soviet authority as still existed in the newly occupied areas was in no position to make them reality. For as well as failing to ensure that the Soviet frontiers were adequately defended, Stalin's leadership had also failed to lay foundations for effective resistance behind German lines. The Soviet leadership had grown averse to irregular warfare after the Bolsheviks had had such difficulty controlling their own irregular troops during the Russian Civil War of 1917 to 1920. Consequently, irregular resistance in the German-occupied Soviet Union was chronically underprepared in 1941. Generally, the men running it on the ground were communist functionaries and bureaucrats rather than actual soldiers. Many were incompetent, and their efforts to organize resistance could be ineffective to the point of farce. For instance, party bosses seeking to organize partisan units in the Crimea took gramophones into the mountains to entertain themselves with, but forgot to take maps. In the Soviet Union's western regions particularly, the speed and suddenness of the German advance thwarted all attempts to assemble some kind of effective effort. The regional authorities could usually offer only destruction battalions, small territorial defense units comprising loyal officials and party members whose duties were now hastily diverted to the task of sabotaging German supply and communications. The Soviet leadership also tried to implant diversion groups, as partisan detachments were then referred to, drawn from Civil War veterans with experience in irregular warfare. These ad hoc efforts were likewise poorly coordinated. Granted, the innumerable bands of fugitive Red Army soldiers cut off by the German advance might form the nucleus of future partisan groups. 2 weeks after the launch of Barbarossa, General Heinritzi wrote to his wife, "The vast forests are still full of scattered soldiers and fugitives, some of them unarmed, some armed, and they are extremely dangerous. Even when we send divisions through these forests, tens of thousands have managed to avoid capture in this impassable terrain." But as yet, the Soviet authorities had no hope of actually organizing such a dispersed, disorganized, and largely weaponless rabble. Moreover, despite the tenets of the War of Annihilation that were a cornerstone of Nazi Germany's war in the East, during the summer of 1941, the Germans' treatment of the bulk of the occupied population had yet to descend to its later depths of terror and rapacity. This, too, was bound to limit any potential for partisan warfare. Such was the almost complete absence of irregular resistance during the war's opening weeks that, while German army commanders did not discard the Barbarossa Decree in principle, they applied its provisions much more selectively than they would later. For instance, the 20th Panzer Division, serving under Panzergruppe 3, forbade its troops to shoot deserters and civilians indiscriminately. And the 4th Mountain Division's commander, the Austrian-born Major General Karl Egelseer, instructed his men to take an interpreter with them and conduct the most rigorous investigation in order to avoid hitting pro-German civilians. Indeed, there is much to suggest that, all other things being equal, Austrian units behaved relatively mildly, in the East anyway. This is not entirely surprising. The number of actual hardcore Nazi supporters in Austria at the time of the Anschluss has been estimated at less than a third, and since then the Nazis had had less time to get to work on the Austrian population than they had on the pre-1938 population of Germany. Add to that a certain aversion towards Prussian-style obduracy that was felt by senior Austrian-born officers, who, after all, had fought in the more ethnically diverse army of the Austro-Hungarian Empire during the First World War. When they did face rare instances of resistance, both German and Austrian-born troops were sometimes too lenient for their commander's tastes. At the beginning of July, for instance, the quartermaster of the 17th Army had to remind its troops of the Barbarossa Decree when he discovered that they were sending partisans to prison camps rather than shooting them. The 99th Light Infantry Division similarly complained that its troops were not cracking down hard enough on partisans. Soviet reports concurred that the Germans were treating the population leniently to a degree, an intelligence report for the Red Army's Northern Front even noting, "Initially, the Germans didn't take anything from the population. Even more, they gave children sweets, peasants sugar." Granted, there were ominous straws in the wind, particularly when it came to plunder. For instance, on 27 July, three motorized corps serving with the 6th Army in the Ukraine excoriated its troops for abducting and slaughtering several pregnant sows, seizing large amounts of hay and ransacking the homes of agricultural workers who had been out in the fields with their families. But the Germans had yet to despoil the land with a locust-like intensity that would characterize so much of their later conduct. The Germans' relatively restrained conduct, together with the antipathy, indeed hostility, that many rural populations felt towards Stalin's regime, led the majority of the newly occupied Soviet populace to adopt a cautious wait-and-see attitude towards the Germans. This attitude was not on a par with the euphoria some German troops had observed on their march into the Baltic states and the Ukraine, but nor was it any kind of foundation for anti-German resistance. "The troops must behave with unconditional correctness towards the population," declared 39 Corps on 12 July. It made two exceptions, Jews and communists. Though the German army showed some moderation towards the general population during the opening phase of Barbarossa, it showed none towards the Soviet Jews. That many ordinary soldiers despised Eastern Jews was perhaps still more apparent in their letters from the Soviet Union than it had been in their letters from Poland. By June 1941, Germany had been at war for 20 months. The Nazi regime had already persuaded the bulk of German society to support, or at least accept, its legal and defamatory assault against the Jews during the 1930s, and German army recruits who had hitherto been through any combination of the Nazi school system, the Hitler Youth, and the RAD, had been subjected to more anti-Semitic propaganda than most. Then, from the war's outbreak, Nazi propaganda portrayed Jews as a treasonous element in German society, and the puppet masters of the enemy coalition the Germans faced in both East and West. Where the East was concerned, of course, German troops had been subjected to a further welter of directives extolling Operation Barbarossa as a campaign to destroy Jewish Bolshevism. Such was the backdrop to the odium with which many German soldiers regarded the Soviet Jews. On the day the invasion started, Lance Corporal Hans S. of the 25th Infantry Division wrote, "The place where we are is swarming with Jews. These begging hyenas are able to exploit the general poverty. Bartering is everywhere." The soldiers' base anti-Semitic sentiments also extended to casually equating Jews with dirt. "Of course, it's nothing like as abundant as in France," wrote Corporal Walter K. of the 25th Infantry Division. "Lots of Jews, lots of filth. There's a squalor here to the houses that one rarely sees elsewhere." Soldiers also bought into the supposed equation between Jews and Bolshevism. In mid-August, for example, Captain Friedrich M. of the 73rd Infantry Division, advancing with the 11th Army through the Ukraine, described a conversation he had had with an ethnic German woman who told him of her experiences under Bolshevism. Among other things, the captain was presented with the image of a poor, stupefied people who were the object of exploitative Jewish rule. "For in every village there sat a Jew who lived well, watched over the people, and paid them a little, 6 to 8 rubles per day, for 10 hours of work." All the indications are that soldiers widely harbored such attitudes, even though only a minority, tens of thousands at most, out of the approximately 10 million Wehrmacht personnel who served in the Soviet Union, became actively involved in measures that contributed to the extermination of the Soviet Jews. Although it would not be August before the OKH issued a general directive to ghettoize the Jews in the army's jurisdiction, advancing army units were swift to exploit the Jewish communities they came into contact with. Frontline and occupation units marked out Jews from early on, subjecting them to humiliating, exploitative, and discriminatory measures. In particular, as portions of the conquered Soviet Union came under military administration, it was the army that argued for putting the Jews in ghettos, albeit with different guidelines across individual jurisdictions. On arrival in Kharkov, for example, the 6th Army's 55 Corps operated with Sonderkommando 4A over the persecution of the Jews. Jewish shops were marked out, and the city commandant ordered the taking of hostages and the building of camps in which Jews, among others, could be held as hostages. Army units also exploited Jews as interpreters, doctors, and street cleaners. "The place is crawling with Jews," wrote Captain Hermann K., an officer serving with the 221st Security Division in mid-July. "We're rounding them all up for work, some to sweep the streets, some to mend them. We've got girls washing and darning and boys to clean our boots. For the last couple of days we've been forcing them all to wear the yellow star. Mind you, to get them to do any of this, we had to set an example first, for the Jew elder had insisted the job mustn't be rushed. He refused our demands to hurry it up, so we had to shoot him. That got the bastards moving." At the end of the month, General Thomas agreed a policy with Paul Körner, State Secretary of the 4-year plan, to quarter the Jews in barracks and use them in units as labor gangs. This was one respect, then, in which the army was already complicit in the fate of the Soviet Jews. Nor, even at this early stage, was this the worst of it. In parts of the Baltic states and the Ukraine, army units stood by as local fanatics, furtively incited by the SS, unleashed atavistic pogroms against Jews that would claim between 12,000 and 24,000 lives. For instance, the 121st Infantry Division witnessed rampaging mobs murdering Jews in Lithuania on 27 June, but neither divisional command nor higher-level commanders made any attempt to intervene. Colonel General Ernst Busch, commanding 16th Army, declared the killings an internal Lithuanian matter. Field Marshal von Leib was appalled by the killings, but concluded in his diary, "We have no influence over these measures. All that remains for us is to keep our distance. His more humane solution was to sterilize Jewish males. The army mainly blamed Jews and communists for such little acts of sabotage as Soviet partisans were already carrying out, so it targeted them in anti-partisan reprisals. The army also had a pragmatic motive for victimizing Jews. It could exploit them, as well as communists, as a demonstration object on whom it could visit terror measures to set an example to the rest of the population. Karl Heinrich von Stulpnagel, commanding the 17th Army in the Ukraine, proclaimed, "Collective reprisals should not be indiscriminate. As long as there is no firm evidence that the Ukrainian population is responsible for an attack, the village headmen should in the first instance be required to select Jewish and communist inhabitants for reprisal. Jewish members of the Young Communists should be singled out particularly as culprits for all sabotage acts and bandit activity." Stulpnagel calculated that the population's widespread dislike of Jews would ensure that it viewed such measures favorably. The most ominous development during the campaign's first 2 months was the mounting scale of SS and police actions against Jews. Until late July, the main forces on the ground were the Einsatzgruppen and the Order Police battalions attached to the Army's security divisions. The first wave of victims comprised mainly Jews in Communist Party positions, though on more than one occasion an Order Police battalion would unleash an indiscriminate massacre under the Army's nose. Such was the case in Białystok in late June, when men of Police Battalion 309, many of them seriously drunk, massacred between 2,000 and 3,000 people in the town's Jewish quarter. The 221st Security Division, which had just captured the town, stood aside while the killings were carried out, expressing no concern for the discipline of those of its own men who might witness them. Indeed, the 221st's war diary covered for the policeman, reporting that the synagogue was set alight because shots were fired from it. In Poland, army commanders generally had at least sought to prevent their own men from witnessing or participating in the anti-Semitic killings perpetrated by the SS Einsatzgruppen. They would do so again in the Soviet Union from late July onwards, as the SS and police accelerated their killing campaign there. That the 221st was apparently so insouciant about its troops potentially witnessing a particularly barbaric massacre may have been down to its having been raised in Silesia, a particularly pro-Nazi region of Germany. Silesia had been forced to relinquish much of its territory to Poland after the First World War. Its industrial base had been ravaged by the economic chaos of the late Weimar years, and during the early 1930s it had responded by voting Nazi in a proportion higher than the Nazi share of the national vote. Certainly the 221st's division-level officers were proudly anti-Semitic. In July, for instance, the division's intelligence officer compiled a report for units about to take over the 221st's jurisdiction as the division itself moved further eastwards. The tensions between the two population groups, Poles and Russians, were exploited by the Jews for their own ends, he wrote. They, the Jews, are now getting the payback for all their swaggering and oppression. It was in late July that SS and police forces began killing on the grand scale. Several factors drove them. Firstly, although many Jews had managed to flee to the Soviet Union's more easterly regions before the Germans arrived, the absolute number of Soviet Jews under German occupation had risen since the campaign's opening weeks. Such Jews might be a potentially useful labor force, but housing and feeding them was likely to get harder. And for the Germans in general, Jews, together with POWs, were lowest in the pecking order when it came to allocating what food remained available. Secondly, as the Germans advanced east, Einsatzgruppe B and Einsatzgruppe C in particular found themselves combing areas that were growing larger and therefore less easy to police. At the same time, because the Wehrmacht had been unable to destroy the Red Army conclusively, the campaign had already lasted longer than originally expected, and the prospect of resistance in the occupied territories was growing. The SS and police were therefore able to gain the army's approval for extending their anti-Semitic killing campaign by depicting Jews as a potential security threat that demanded radical measures. During the second half of July, therefore, the SS and police began killing not just Jews in Communist Party positions, but also adult male Jews across the board. The SS and police also started killing more Jews because they had the practical means to do so. The three Waffen-SS brigades, two infantry and one cavalry, had been drawn up for deployment in the East in May 1941, but were initially assigned to frontline duties. By late July, however, both they and the expanded order police forces were arriving in the rear areas, and the Army's rear area commanders were approving their transfer to the tactical command of the senior SS and police leaders. From then on, the SS and police had over 30,000 order police and Waffen-SS personnel operating in the rear areas on top of about 3,500 men from the four Einsatzgruppen. In the coming months, as anti-Jewish measures also escalated elsewhere in German-occupied Europe,